Hello, you are listening to Lowell Association for the Blind's LAB Radio. LAB Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network, your main source of accessible community news and information, located in Lowell, Massachusetts. We read local news, editorials, feature stories, and more. LAB Radio is brought to you by volunteers and staff of the Lowell Association for the Blind. I am Jean Creedberg, and with me is...
Ken Creedberg. Good morning.
And Ken and I will be reading to you this morning from the Lowell Sun of Sunday, January 4, 2026. And Happy New Year to all. The lead story, Christchurch United, Perfect Storm, Pandemic Habits, Dwindling Congregation Numbers Led to Decision to Leave East Merrimack Street Location. And this, a large color picture of Christchurch United of Lowell on January 2, 2026, will have its service of leave taking on January 18th as the dwindling congregation looks to other venues for worship services in Greater Lowell. By Peter Currier, Lowell. Amid declining congregation numbers, rising maintenance costs, and difficulty bouncing back from the COVID-19 pandemic, Christchurch United of Lowell will have its final Sunday service later this month as the remaining congregation looks to other venues in Greater Lowell. About 20 years ago, legacy pastor Reverend Ross Allen said CCU boasted a congregation of several hundred people. In the intervening years, that number has shrunk and today stands at just about 15 people. There are a number of reasons for this, Allen told the Sun in a phone call Monday. With the pandemic, the rise in the cost of maintaining the historic building and pastoral transitions creating a perfect storm over the last several years, leading to the church's decision to leave its 180 East Merrimack Street location. It was just really hard to come back from. COVID changed a lot of patterns for how people went about their lives, said Allen. Allen has been the full-time pastor for CCU since August after serving there part-time, starting earlier in the summer, and said he has brought on at that time with the understanding that he would be helping the church in its closure process. Allen has been involved in this process before when he joined the South Acton Congregational Church. In Acton, Allen said the congregation was larger with about 40 people, but the financial woes for the church were greater than that CCU faces in Lowell. I helped them find a sister church to be adopted by in West Concord, and I was with them for a year before I made my way over here to help this church in Lowell, said Allen. The final Sunday service for CCU, known as the Service for Leave-Taking, L-E-A-V-E, will take place January 18 at 2 p.m. Between now and then, Allen said, the effort will be focused around finding new homes for the many sacred objects in the church's sanctuary and for general supplies other churches could possibly use, like TVs or sound equipment. Allen said he has a great deal of admiration for the congregation at CCU. It is a really hard decision to call it when it is time, said Allen. In a call with the Sun Monday, CCU board chair Dennis Kearney compared churches to a forest full of trees. Trees grow, get old, fall over, and make room for more trees. There have been many churches throughout history and many churches in America, said Kearney. And sometimes you have a tree that has lived its life, and the right thing to do is to close your ministry well and faithfully to make sure what you have is shepherded carefully so new trees can grow. Kearney said there had been a lot of conversation about whether the East Merrimack Street property was the best place for the church and its congregation in 2026. If the congregation was as large or larger than it was once was, Kearney noted there would be little space for people to park near the church on Sundays. Some congregants have left Greater Lowell altogether, moving to Boston or as far as Arizona and beyond, Kearney said. While that has consequences for the future of the congregation in Lowell, he said, it can also be seen as a positive because, in a way, our church has spread its seed far and wide, as one tree is a larger and a larger forest. But the consequence is that the ground is no longer fertile here, not for this kind of church. There were days when people could walk down the street to this kind of church. Those days are no longer here, said Kearney. For now, CCU is coming up with a plan to possibly nest with the First Congregational Church in Billerica beginning later this month, though Kearney said a final decision by the congregation was still pending. For the church building in Lowell, Allen said, the property will be sold, and it is set to become a new campus for All People Church of North Reading in February. The church building itself was first organized as the High Street Congregational Church in 1846. In 1918, due in part to fuel shortages from America's involvement in World War I, HSCC and the First Unitarian Church began worshiping together and later became the All Souls Church. From that union, All Souls Highland Congregational Church and the First Congregational Church in Lowell would then merge in 1969 to become CCU. In 1990, the building's long evolution continued when the congregation began sharing the space with Lao and Spanish-speaking congregations. And in 2001, the church became an open and affirming congregation, making it one of the earliest churches to be inclusive of LGBTQ people. And there are two more pictures of the church. Christ Church United of Lowell it will have its service of leave taking on January 18 as the dwindling congregation looks to other venues for worship services in Greater Lowell. Sad. You hate to see that happen in any faith. Ken, do you have something for us?
Yes, I do, Jeannie. And now I'll be reading from the local news section of the Sunday Set. I'm going to be reading the column. Rourke Nguyen face off for mayor. Monday's inauguration features whispers of a shadow candidate. By tomorrow, Lowell will have a newly sworn-in city council and mayor. Voters elect the former, councilors select the latter. Three of the 11 councilors, Belinda Jurin, Sean McDonough, and Sidney Lang, are new to the body, and their first official vote as a member will be for mayor. Only current mayor Dan Rourke and at-large councilor Vesna Nguyen have publicly announced their candidacy for the two-year term. Rourke was uncontested for his Pawtucketville seat, while Nguyen was the top vote-getter in a crowded field of five balloted at-large candidates. The column hears credible accounts that Monday's contest features a whisper campaign, along with acolytes applying pressure to the new councilors for their vote for a shadow candidate. Backroom political maneuverings and deals have historically been common sport for the unelected seat. But both Nguyen and Rourke made their public bids early. And given that the three new councillors advocated for transparency and accountability in government, it will be increasingly interesting to see if they vote for the candidates of record or for some other behind-the-scenes player. The vote is symbolically important for the tone it sets in a city looking to rise above its peer gateway cities in the areas of employment, education, housing, governance, and more. The councillors vote in alphabetical order following their swearing in. Zachary Chow, John Descoto, Eric Kitcher, Belinda Jurin, Sidney Lang, Sean McDonough, Rita Mercier, Nguyen, Corey Robinson, Rourke, and Kim Scott. Rourke made his final pitch to the public and his colleagues in a text to The Sun on Thursday. Nguyen did not respond to a request for comment on his candidacy. It's been an incredible honor to serve the city of Lowell as mayor, and I'm incredibly proud of what we've accomplished together over the past 2 years, including Lowell becoming the first front-runner city in the nation, Rourke said. I've been deep to respect for my colleagues on the city council, and I've always worked to build consensus and move our city forward collaboratively. I hope to have the opportunity to serve again as mayor so I can continue the important work underway and further strengthen the relationships we've built with our partners for the benefit of Lowell. And that part of the column was written by Melanie Gilbert. Endorsement alert. In other election news, it's a special election season, and that means three things: candidates, fundraising, and endorsements. In October, the state Senate set a special primary election for the first Middlesex District seat, previously held by the late Ed Kennedy. Kennedy, age 74, died at Lowell General Hospital on October 1st after an illness less than a year into his latest term in a seat held since the election of 2018. The special election primary is set for February 3rd, with the general election on March 3rd. After redistricting in 2021, the first Middlesex Senate district includes Lowell, Draycott, Dunstable, Pepperell, and Tingsboro. State Representative Rodney Elliott in the 16th Middlesex district was the first to announce his candidacy for the Senate seat. State Representative Vanna Howard, 17th Middlesex District, announced her bid shortly after. Sam Eas told The Sun last month that he is seeking the Republican nomination for the seat via a write-in campaign. Joe Espinola of Draycott is an unenrolled candidate via social media, but has not filed with the Massachusetts Office of Campaign and Political Finance. There may be other self-proclaimed candidates, but The Sun is the only highlighting those who have filed an organization statement with the OCPF. Running for office is like an intricate dance. you have to make the right moves at the right time in order not to get tripped up. Both Elliott and Howard are hitting their marks by already holding fundraisers. Next up, securing endorsements, with Elliott first to release an impressive roster of supporters. Although not required to, generally supporters contribute to a candidate's campaign coffers, so the list of names and organizations represents a candidate's growing political war chest. The former Lowell City Councilor has locked up 6 of the 11 current councilors. On the school committee side, Elliott secured the support of 4 of the 7 members. Given the seat's geographical reach, Elliott has also been endorsed by 7 of the 8 Tingsboro-based Greater Lowell Technical High School committee members. And since he seems to be leaving nothing to chance, Elliott's announcement also included the various unions, such as the IBEW and SEIU-affiliated locals, and firefighter and teacher unions. Former Congresswoman Nikki Tsongas publicly announced her endorsement of Howard in a New Year's Eve Day statement. Tsongas represented Massachusetts' 5th and then 3rd district from 2007 to 2019. Howard worked for Tsongas, helping constituents in Lowell, Draycott, Dunstable, Pepperell, and Tingsboro, plus 30 additional towns and cities. Her work focused on navigating housing, veterans services, and immigration challenges. As families across Greater Lowell struggle with rising costs, housing pressures, and access to health care, our state senator must be a strong and effective voice for the 1st Middlesex District, Tsongas said. Grounded in her own experience as a newcomer who faced homelessness and learned the importance of community support, Vanna has devoted her life to public service and deep work with local nonprofits, which is why I am proud to enthusiastically endorse her. Should either Elliott or Howard win this special election, their representative seat would become open and thereby create opportunities for others who aspire to higher office. Still, endorsements and even mountains of campaign cash do not a winner make, as the recent Lowell City Council election proved, where lesser-known and funded candidates thumped incumbents. The electorate is restless and ready to rumble. Messaging and policy positions may matter more to voters who will be asking some tough questions of candidates in a year in which municipal budgets are expanding while revenues are falling. Local taxes and energy costs are rising and incomes are flattening or even going away. This special election could well be a harbinger of the upcoming 2026 races. Voters can find their polling location at sec.state.ma.us/Where Do I Vote MA? And this part of the column was written by Melanie Gilbert. The First Candidate Forum. Coalition for a Better Acre has invited the candidates in the special primary election for the 1st Middlesex Senate District seat to participate in a candidate forum titled Who wants to be our state senator? Friday, January 23rd, from 5:30 to 7 p.m. at the Mercer Community Center, 21 Salem Street. The nonprofit membership-based community development corporation has a long history of civic engagement and neighborhood empowerment. CEO Dan Rivera said the CBA invites CBA members, ACRE members, CBA board members, staff, coalition agencies, and the press to join us for a night for food, fun, and a panel discussion with the candidates for state senate. The special election calendar represents a tight deadline for candidates to introduce themselves to the voting public. Some, like Elliot, Howard, and Meese, have not only publicly announced, but have filed papers certifying their candidacy. Rivera said the forum will welcome Elliot, Howard, and unenrolled candidate Joe Espinola to debate the issues of the day. The Sun reached out to Rivera for clarification on why a candidate who has not filed with the OCPF would be invited to participate. He said by email that the CBA was relying on guidance from the Secretary of State. Thanks for the question, Rivera said. I agree it's tough to discern who is actually in. I emailed election@sec.state.ma.us and got his response December 30th that, at this time, the following candidates have qualified for the ballot. Rodney Michael Elliott, Democrat. Vanna Howard, Democrat. Joe Espinola, unenrolled independent. And this part of the column was also written by Melanie Gilbert. Funeral services announced for Phil Shea. Family and friends are invited to attend Phil Shea's calling hours on Wednesday, January 7th from 3 to 7 p.m. at the Fay McCabe Funeral Home, 105 Moore Street in Lowell. His funeral will begin on Thursday morning at 9 a.m. from the funeral home, followed by a funeral mass at 10 a.m. at St. Patrick's Church, 282 Suffolk Street. Burial will follow at St. Catherine Cemetery, 20 Pine Ridge Road, Westford. Shea died Tuesday morning. He was 84. Remembrances continued to come in for a man who was described as a proud son of Lowell by Massachusetts Secretary of State William Galvin. Shea described himself as a kid from the acre, referring to his early years growing up in North Common Village, the city's family housing complex. Senator Shea was a true public servant who extended his hand to friendship and always helped those who were disadvantaged, Lowell City Manager Tom Golden said. Shea's political career brought him from the Lowell City Council to the state legislature in the 70s and 80s, serving as a representative and then a senator. His many contributions to the community were remembered by State Representative Vanna Howard, who said she valued both his friendship and sage counsel. He was one of my go-to advisors on many issues, Howard said. He not only was a friend, but also someone I could pick up the phone to call. He was always generous with his time. We served on the LHA, Lowell Housing Authority, board, together when I was the chair. I'm missing our coffee time. This also was written by Melanie Gilbert. New year, new federal funding fiasco. Welcome to a brand new year and a brand new reason for more money to be removed from your wallet despite getting the same level of service or worse. The most notable of these new methods of freeing many of you from that pesky money is the expiration of the Affordable Care Act premium tax credits, which made monthly health insurance payments significantly more affordable for more than 20 million Americans. The thing is, this was something we knew was coming in advance, since so much political capital was spent in 2025 to push for and against the extension of these credits. One could not have possibly missed that this was a possibility, though it never should have been one to begin with. We are hit with the shock news to start off the year that the Trump administration would be freezing federal child care funding for all states. For those who have been wisely living under a rock, this started out as President Trump's latest vindictive crusade against the state of Minnesota, where a year-long story about alleged fraud in daycare got fresh legs with new charges for six defendants last month. Child care funding for Minnesota was cut off this week, followed quickly and arbitrarily by the other 49 states. If there was fraud, and it does look like fraud, was occurring in some instances, then those people accountable, that is perfectly fine if it is genuinely occurring. The problem, though, is that the Trump administration is now making the same mistake the state government in Massachusetts is making in its enforcement of the MBTA communities law, withholding funding that was meant to help children who had no say at any point in the process. Trump obviously has no problem with fraud, given the number of convicted fraudsters he has gone out of his way to pardon in his second term. Those who have enriched themselves with funding meant to benefit children do deserve to have the book thrown at them. However, this federal government is clearly only pushing this case because it was committed primarily by a group of Somali Americans in a state led by a prominent Trump critic, creating another excuse for Trump to demonize an other. With these two petty significant government funding changes, in addition to all the other ways the Trump administration has sought to screw the American people over, it is a good time to remember that a lot of people who were just barely holding on financially are now in an even worse spot than they were a week ago. In this new year, make sure to check in on your loved ones if you think these changes will impact them. The holidays are already a tough time financially and emotionally for many people, and for many that may have spilled into 2026 now that health insurance is more expensive and federal funding for childcare is in limbo. More people in your life may have relied on these things than you realize, and things may not be great for them at the moment. And this part of the column was written by Peter Currier. Calm before a storm? The past few weeks have seemed quite among the various actors in Drake at school district controversy. But will a new year reignite the furor? The town election is on May 2nd, 5 months away. But an incumbent school committee member, Renee Young, was announced she will seek re-election for a third term. Only one seat available this year. Rightly or wrongly, there has been considerable emotion spent about which it is. Young has found herself attacked on several fronts, including her support of the school superintendent and school department procurement procedures. Those procedures caused town meeting in November to support an audit of some aspects of school operations. At a joint meeting in September, relations with the Board of Selectmen, the town manager, and other town employees deteriorated, and those relations were never good. Efforts to hold another joint meeting have never been productive. Among the fellow board member, Allison Volpe, Young was the subject of a recall campaign in the fall. That campaign, organized by Allison, Allie Marie Stillian, fell apart. In the midst of the recall effort, Young and Volpe sent a cease and desist order to Stillian, calling much of the campaign's claims inaccurate. It was after the cease and desist order was delivered that things seemed to calm down, but issues with the school department remain. Now the school department is involved in significant changes to its top management structure. Stillian ran for school committee last year, but finished third, more than 500 votes behind Linda Truville, who came in first. Volpe finished second. One observer of Draycott politics believes Young will still have an opponent this year, and it still could be Stillian. And this part of the column was written by Prudence Brighton. And that's the column for this week, Jeannie.
Okay, thank you very much, Ken. I'm moving on to the education section of the paper. The UMass Lowell seeks solutions to housing crisis. And there is a large picture of Bay State leaders and innovators gathered at the November 6, 2025 to celebrate the designation of 14 tech hubs as part of the Massachusetts Tech Hubs program. Greater Lowell has been designated a housing innovation tech hub led by UMass Lowell. From left, we have pictures of Economic Development Secretary Eric Paley, UMass Lowell Associate Vice Chancellor for Research and Innovation Acceleration, Kim Holloway, Lieutenant Governor Kim Driscoll, and Mass Tech CEO Carolyn Kirk. Another picture shows UMass Lowell Associate Vice Chancellor for Research and Innovation Acceleration, Kim Holloway, accepting an award from Lieutenant Governor Kim Driscoll for the Housing Innovation Tech Hub. Lowell. UMass Lowell is in partnership with local government developers and community organizations, is looking to tackle one of Massachusetts' biggest challenges, housing availability. The Healy Driscoll administration and the Innovation Institute at the Massachusetts Technology Collaborative announced November 6 that Greater Lowell has been designated a housing innovation tech hub through the Massachusetts Tech Hub programs, an initiative intended to strengthen regional innovation ecosystems across the state. The designation is part of the program's first cohort of 14 tech hubs recognized statewide. These tech hubs reflect the best of what happens when local leaders, institutions, and businesses work together to build on their region's unique strengths, said Lieutenant Governor Kim Driscoll. Our administration believes that innovation doesn't just happen in one zip code. It happens in every community when we provide the tools and investment to help it thrive. Led by UMass Lowell and funded by a $100,000 strategy development grant, the Housing Innovation Tech Hub aims to address the Commonwealth's housing crisis through innovation in design and sustainability, zoning and policy, and manufacturing and construction. The Tech Hub will serve as a living laboratory for testing and scaling new approaches to affordable and sustainable housing. The Tech Hubs program represents a long-term commitment to building the next generation of innovation ecosystems in Massachusetts, said Innovation Institute Director Pat Larkin. By leveraging the experiences of the different regional initiatives, we're laying the foundation for sustained regional transformation and economic competitiveness, Larkin said. Excuse me. According to the Healy-Driscoll administration's A Home for Everyone, a Comprehensive Housing Plan for Massachusetts, Massachusetts needs to increase its year-round housing supply by at least 222,000 homes over the next decade to meet demand and lower costs, the report found. The Mass Incorporated Policy Center has found the housing need is pronounced in gateway cities such as Lowell, which will need 83,000 new units over the next decade. To address this challenge, the team behind the Housing Innovation Tech Hub, including officials from UMass Lowell, the City of Lowell, the Cambridge Innovation Center, Massachusetts Competitive Partnership, and BeQual, will develop a strategic plan that delivers scalable housing solutions through the integration of cutting-edge technology, transformative policy frameworks, and community-driven approaches. The strategy development grant allows us to convene the right partners and create an actionable roadmap for housing innovation, said Kim Halloway, Associate Vice Chancellor for Research and Innovative Acceleration at UMass Lowell. Our goal is to turn research and ideas into real projects that can transform how housing is built and financed across Massachusetts. Centered in Greater Lowell, the Tech Hub will test and refine new approaches that can be replicated statewide, positioning the area as a proving ground for housing innovation across Massachusetts. Lowell has always been a city that leads through innovation, said Lowell City Manager Tom Golden. This effort builds on that legacy and makes Lowell the launch pad for the future of housing across the state, creating solutions that are affordable, sustainable, and scalable for communities everywhere. The Housing Innovation Tech Hub builds on the momentum of the Lowell Innovation Network Corridor, a partnership between the university, industry, and government focused on a 1.2 million square foot mixed-use development that will include offices, research labs, housing, retail businesses, and entertainment destinations. Together, the Tech Hub and LINC will make the Greater Lowell region a national model for housing innovation and economic opportunity. The Housing Innovation Tech Hub represents exactly the kind of forward-looking collaboration that defines UMass Lowell, said Chancellor Julie Chen. Along with transformational projects like LINC, the Tech Hub reflects how we're bringing research and partnerships to life to strengthen communities and expand opportunities across the region. Ken?
Thank you, Jeannie. And now I'm going to be reading one of the lead articles from the local news section of the Sunday Sun. And this column is entitled, Middlesex Jail and House of Correction, Removing Unnecessary Barriers. Sheriff touts naloxone vending machine success 1 year on. And this article was written by Peter Currier. Bill Ricker, it has been 1 year since the Middlesex Sheriff's Office installed a naloxone vending machine at the Middlesex Jail and House of Correction. And officials said the machine has been used dozens of times. The unconventional vending machine was installed in December 2024 to provide free naloxone kits with two doses each to people visiting and working at the facility. Naloxone, commonly known by the brand name Narcan, is an overdose reversal medication that can stop a possible fatal opioid drug overdose. The drug has long been a tool kept by law enforcement and emergency responders as the opioid epidemic began, resulting in an increasing number of overdoses, many of which would be fatal. MSO staff members have had access to naloxone since 2016. Since the vending machine was installed, it has been used to access 205 naloxone kits. Each of the 205 kits shared with community represents a potential life saved, said Middlesex Sheriff Peter J. Katugian. The continued use of naloxone vending machine shows we are removing unnecessary barriers to this critical resource. We will do everything we can to support and care for those struggling with substance use, whether they will be our visitors, agency partners, co-workers, or their loved ones. At the House of Correction in Billerica, more than 40% of incarcerated persons have been diagnosed with some sort of substance use disorder. The addition of the vending machine for overdose reversal drugs is considered an extension of the MSO medication-assisted treatment and directed opioid recovery program. The machine can be accessed anonymously at the MSO's Visitor Center in Billerica, where it shows instructions on how to administer naloxone in the event of somebody else having an overdose. By arming the loved ones of individuals with an opioid use disorder with naloxone, we are empowering people with a life-saving tool to deploy in the critical moments following an overdose, said Katugian. We just as we would with any first aid material, we are committed to making sure people are educated in emergency use until first responders can arrive. Jeannie?
Okay, thanks, Kim. Here's another interesting article from the Education Department, or section, I should say. 16 Chelmsford High School students were honored during the National Merit Recognition Breakfast held in the school's Career and College Readiness Center on November 20. Chelmsford. 16 students earned national merit recognition. 16 Chelmsford High School students, along with their families, were invited to attend a special National Merit Recognition Breakfast at CHS on November 20 to celebrate their academic achievements. One of those students, senior Jacob Lazar, has been named a semifinalist in the National Merit Scholarship Program, meaning he represents the top 0.5% of the state's senior students and remains in the running to earn a National Merit Scholarship. The other 15 students recognized earned commended status in the National Merit Scholarship Program. They are, and I'll wish me luck with these names, folks, Pranav Ajmera, Samhita Badri, Reese Boker, Jade Boyer, Jackson Chladzinski, Catherine Evans, Madeline Finkel, Om Judge, that's J-U-G-E, Sarada Kompana, Harika Mandava, Soham Mayani, Claire Mulligan-Hawk, Vinay Murugan, Urja Sharma, and Milan Sondhi. "I'm really proud of all of you. We all are," said Chelmsford High School Principal Stephen Murray. "And thank you to the parents. They obviously wouldn't be here and be so successful without all of your support. It's quite an achievement." The National Merit Scholarship Program is an annual academic competition among high school students for recognition and college undergraduate scholarships that began in 1955. The program is conducted by National Merit Scholar Corporation, a not-for-profit organization that operates without government assistance. United States high school students enter the National Merit Scholarship Program by taking the preliminary SAT National Merit Scholarship Qualifying Test, which serves as an initial screen of over 1.3 million entrants each year, and by meeting published program entry and participation requirements. To learn more about the National Merit Scholarship Program, visit nationalmerit.org. And then there's an incredible number of slashes and numbers and letters. I'm not going to read it, folks. It's way too long. I would guess if you go to National Merit Scholarship Program, visit nationalmerit.org. There's also a picture here of Chelmsford High School senior Jacob Lazar. He's been named the semifinalist in the National Merit Scholarship Program. A real smarty pants, I guess. Good for them, huh? Ken?
Thank you, Jeannie. And now we're going to read the other lead article in the local news section of the Sunday Sun. And this column is entitled 40B Housing. Methuen appeals Murphy's Farm. City argues traffic will acutely and severely affect in its effort to halt project. And this column was written by Prudence Brighton. Drake it. Traffic generated by Murphy's Farm, the proposed 200 units of apartments in East Draycott, will acutely and severely affect neighboring Methuen. This is the substance of the problem the city has with the project and why it seeks to halt its development, according to appeal filed December 29th with the Massachusetts Land Court. initially proposed as a mix of 300 units of affordable and market-rating apartments, Murphy's Farm was granted a comprehensive permit by the Zoning Board of Appeals on December 4th. Comprehensive permits are issued under the state's Chapter 40B law to consolidate the approval process for affordable housing. Access to Murphy's Farm is from Wheeler Street, which sits on the Dracut-Methuen border. In fact, the town-city border runs right down the middle of the street. Wheeler Street intersects routes 110 and 113, which run through Dracut and Methuen, and are two of the region's primary access points to Interstate 93. The city will have no benefit from the 200 units of proposed housing, which will be located in Dracut, but will sustain all of the adverse traffic and safety impacts of all projects related travel through already overburdened travel routes located solely in Methuen, the appeal states. The complaint states that Methuen retained a traffic peer review consultant who made several recommendations concerning intersection and roadway improvements directly necessitated by the project, and these improvements should be funded by O'Brien Homes, an Andover firm headed by Kevin O'Brien. The number of units the ZBA approved in December is substantially reduced from the 300 units on 50 acres and the 268 units O'Brien and the board had agreed to in August. From the beginning, the size of the project drew vehement opposition led by a group Citizens Against Reckless Development in Dracut, which has a Facebook following of nearly 1,000 members. The comprehensive permit was granted conditionally December 4th, trimming the number of units to 200 garden-style apartments. That action by the ZBA is one of the reasons that O'Brien is appealing the board's decision. As a developer, O'Brien's appeal will be handled by the House Appeals Committee, a unit of the Executive Office of Housing and Livable Communities. ZBA member Scott Mallory cautioned board members that O'Brien and his team has not been given time to review the new limit of 200 units. That came very late in the process, he said. O'Brien's attorney, Donald Bornstein, highlighted this in the notice sent to the Housing Appeals Committee. The 200-unit limit was first mentioned publicly at the end of the public hearing process. Bornstein called the inclusion in order of conditions arbitrary and capricious. The board did not receive any evidence or testimony about the economic effect of limiting the number of units to 200 and reducing the size of the project by approximately 25%, the notice of appeal stated. Jeannie?
Okay, thank you, Ken. We've got a few minutes here. I think I can get some of this article in. State House student represents MCC at hearing. On October 14th, Middlesex Community College student Kayla Kittredge of Lowell testified at the racial equity hearing at the Massachusetts State House. Part of the psychology and criminal and social justice programs, Middlesex nominated Kittredge as a speaker because of her advocacy work on campus. I wanted to participate in the racial equity hearing because I believe education should be a tool for liberation, not exclusion, Kittredge said. My story and my studies both revolve around building systems rooted in justice, care, and equity. Speaking at the State House gave me the opportunity to use my voice to protect the very programs that made my survival and my success, and thousands more like me, possible. During the hearing, Kittredge spoke in front of the Joint Committee of Racial Equity, Civil Rights, and Inclusion about how recent federal decisions and cuts to diversity, equity, and inclusion funding affect students. Focusing on her experience as an MCC student employee and TRIO student, she shared how the programs make a positive impact on a student's ability to complete their education. On October 22, Kittredge participated in a tech-in at MCC titled Community Healing Through Transformative Justice, Building a Future Beyond Punishment. During the event, MCC students, employees, and community members learned more about mass incarceration, systemic racism, and the collective power of healing. The full-day event featured a screening of A Murder in Boston, as well as a panel discussion. As a student, an organizer, and someone who believes deeply in the power of education as liberation, this space reminded me that learning doesn't only happen in classrooms. It happens in community, Kittredge said. It happens when we tell the truth about systems of harm, when we listen to those directly impacted, and when we imagine something better together. A member of the Student Government Association, Kittredge participates in as many campus events as possible. She believes in being part of the community, helping to create dialogue and ensure the college continues to grow. As an MCC liberal arts ambassador, she also works with MCC Dean Matthew Hurwitz to make the curriculum more accessible to all students. These experiences have grounded my education in empathy and action, Kittredge said. Working in student support showed me the real barriers students face while studying under Professor Jonathan Bennett gave me the intellectual tools to understand those barriers. Combined with the advocacy work done as a liberal arts ambassador, these experiences shaped me into both a scholar and activist. Kittredge was drawn to MCC because of the college's commitment to access and meeting students where they are. At Middlesex, she benefits from programs and opportunities that challenge her, professors who offer support and guidance, and real-world experiences that go beyond the classroom. After graduating from Middlesex, Kittredge plans to transfer to a four-year institution to study education, social justice, and public policy. Calling her experience at MCC life-changing, her hope is to continue the work she started at Middlesex to use her voice to build systems that uplift others. MCC gave me stability when my world felt uncertain, community when I felt alone, and a voice I never knew I had, she said. Here, I learned to turn hardship into leadership and to see education as a form of resistance. MCC taught me to see my story not as something to overcome, but as something powerful, to use both my intellect and my empathy as tools for change. Well, that's all we have for you today, folks. We wish you a good day. There is some snow coming in, so if you have to get out there now. But it is cold, so bundle up.
Have a great week and stay warm.
And once again, Happy New Year. Stay tuned for more coming your way.